Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 15th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Gail Gamuff McCoy. Today's session number is GAG-2001-3, and it's titled Aspects of Prostitution. Let's listen in.
Good afternoon. Thank you for all coming on this really hot day. It's tough to be inside, and I think it's tough to be outside in both places. We've been discussing for the last few days international trafficking and prostitution, and this is the third part in a series, and on each day we've been discussing different issues and topics. It hasn't repeated itself. This will be the last day that we talk about international trafficking and prostitution, and then tomorrow I'll speak about the program in Chicago that we have that's called Genesis House, and it's now the largest program in the United States, which addresses the needs of women and girls in prostitution and their rehabilitation. So we'll end our series on trafficking today. And what we're going to end it with today is we've been talking a lot about what a huge global problem it is and the fact that it's estimated that between 700,000 and 2 million women and girls and some men are trafficked annually, mostly for prostitution and the sex trade, but other kinds of things are labor, begging, and so on. Today we're going to try and look at some of the proposed solutions, what people have done nationally and internationally, what the laws are, and what you as people in your congregations, people in your community, what kinds of things you can support politically, what kinds of things you can do in your community. I think it's really important to remember that even in the smallest communities, this is going on. An example of this is we were chosen by the state of Illinois to train the entire state different agencies on doing outreach to sex workers. And one thing we found out was going into the smallest towns in Illinois that women were working in truck stops, women were working in laundromats, women were working in supermarkets. And so no one's really immune from this. And I know in Illinois we're one of the largest points of immigration for Latinos. And we're having a lot of issues. I have suburbs way out calling me, like Aurora, the town of Rockford, calling Genesis House and saying, we have trafficked women, we have minors, we have runaways from other states. What are we going to do about this problem? So it's not just a big city problem. It's really everywhere in the United States. So what is being done in the United States? Well, because it's become such a huge problem, the administration and Congress have addressed the issue, and that was largely because of President Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright, who really became very involved in the issue of trafficking. Other countries are being urged to have international policies, although there's difficulty coming to consensus, but I'll talk later about some of the acts that have been passed. President Clinton had an international crime control strategy. It was an interagency group that he set up and involved the State Department, the CIA, the FBI, and the INS, immigration, trying to just have some kind of strategies. And he was really the first to begin any type of strategy about international trafficking and prostitution. So in 1998, he gave a directive, and the directive looked at three aspects. Prevention, number one, which is always key and very important. Protection and support for the victims of trafficking, and how do we do that? And what do we do about getting stiffer penalties to prosecute these traffickers? So he outlined the need for programs that increase economic opportunities for victims. In other words, do we do it by foreign aid, finding especially the countries we know that are trafficking their girls and women, and do we help them there? What do we do once the person ends up here? How do we help them? Do we eventually send them back to their country but prepare them for that? Do we give them special status? And there's a lot of questions that, and there's a lot of debate over all of this. So some of the things he's proposing are unclear, but and there's still debate over them, but some things have been passed. The other thing they talked about was dissemination of information in other countries and in the United States and education. As you know, this topic is not a widely known topic. It's just very recently that you begin to see maybe television programs about it, some magazine articles about it. It's just now coming out. So he wants to further increase the education here, but also in other countries, what to look out for, training and education for the girls to know when they're being duped and they're going to a travel agency perhaps or an employment agency that's not legitimate. So that's some of the things he's looking at. And thirdly, which is really important, is to increase the research funding. I mean, I think you can realize when people are estimating from between 700,000 to 2 million that there's really not enough good research, there's not a good database being collected, nobody's on the same page. So research funding and what's really happening again to the girls. And we talk about that with prostitution as well. What are the real issues with women in prostitution? And why do we stand, our group, firmly against legalization of prostitution? And that's because we do research on what the issues are and what's happened to them as children and how they ended up in prostitution. So he wants to increase research funding, which I think is great, because until the 90s, there was very little research even on prostitution, or it was very sporadic. He wants to have, from victim protection and assistance, he wants to provide shelter, increase support services to victims, which would be counseling, because if they're in this country illegally, they're really not eligible for any assistance. Yes?
You keep referring to he wants to do. These are things that Bill Clinton initiated. Are they on standstill now with Bush administration?
No, I'll talk about this. This act was passed.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
No,
this is what he proposed and what was passed. He wants them to receive, yesterday I talked about a visa, which is called the T visa. T stands for trafficking. So he wants to have a special T visa, and that is still being debated. The visa issue is very huge, and it hasn't been solved yet, and that did not go through on the act. And that would, if you had this T visa and you had been trafficked, you would receive assistance in some way with what had happened to you. You could become a witness, which would help to prosecute the traffickers, and you would be supported to go home and probably have some financial support when you got there, so you didn't come back to your country without any kind of money or way to set up another life. The other thing, again, we look at prosecution and enforcement, and that's pressing for better and more laws. And that is something, as a community, that we can do. The laws, as I was talking about yesterday, are inadequate. It's less penalty to traffic a human being than drugs. And trafficking human beings is, unfortunately, the gift that keeps on giving, as we've talked about. Once you've trafficked that person and she's being prostituted, she continues to make money for you. So it's a lot better financially for them to traffic individuals. For those of you who weren't here, I'll repeat, it's the third largest money maker for organized crime internationally today, after drugs and guns. Drugs first, guns, and then trafficking human beings. Mainly girls and women, girls as young as 7 years old are used sexually in brothels. So this bill then gave better laws to effectively prosecute traffickers and increase the penalties against them to bring them as high as the laws for drug trafficking. Also, restitution would be given to trafficked victims from the monies that are taken from traffickers. So in other words, if they're prosecuted and they're fined, that money will go into a fund to assist the victims that have been trafficked. The other thing that they presented, which hasn't been done, is that new laws. We need new laws, and they're still working on that. And later I'll talk about this bill did have an amendment, which is now waiting to be passed. So one of the other things would be education, massive education for the Departments of Justice, the INS, and all these other legal individuals and officials to be able to recognize traffickers. What do they look like? What do the victims look like? How do you understand this? Because most of them are really just getting through because there hasn't been any education of our officials and it hasn't been consistent. You know, one person might know something in the FBI, the other person doesn't know. So there's not any consistency in the education and training of our officials. The next thing we need to do, and they decided to start with U.S. embassies, and look at the embassies in all these different countries and consulates and try and get on the same page with the countries, try and have some interaction going on at the embassy level with the consulates to try and address this issue in each particular country where we're having tremendous problems with trafficking. So this was called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, and it passed in the year 2000. So what actually came out in the bill and what were the key provisions in the bill is that it now just directs the Secretary of State to include information on trafficking in the Secretary of State's report on different countries. So when we look at issues in the UN and so on, she will have that report just like human rights violations. There will be a report on who is trafficked. It also establishes an interagency collaboration, which I talked about a little bit earlier. So all the agencies are going to have a task force and begin to look seriously at trafficking. There's going to be a campaign, and I'm not technically part of it, but apparently I'm involved in it, to increase public awareness about the issues of trafficking and prostitution, and there should be some funding coming for that. The biggest problem remains to establish programs in foreign countries. And again, how do you resettle someone? How do you reintegrate someone back into their community? And can they be eligible? We have in this country what's called a crime victims fund. You might be aware of it. If you're a victim of a crime, and I think your loss is over, and I can't remember, something like $500 or $1,000, they're then eligible for a crime victims fund. And you could apply for that. It's not very well advertised, actually. I think any citizen is actually able to apply for that. So they want these women, even though they're not citizens, to be able to apply for this fund, because there's a lot of money there in the crime victims fund to enable them to get back or whatever it is they need to do to get to their country. Another big problem that the efforts have not filtered down to the lower law enforcement, to the Chicago police. So Chicago, or to the local police, so in terms of O'Hare, Chicago policemen might be totally unaware of what, again, the FBI is doing, the INS is doing. And as I told you, in Chicago, there are two agents assigned. Can you imagine to O'Hare Airport with the magnitude of the people that are coming in and out of the international airport there? So everybody, there's just not enough funding and not enough people. The big problem, there's a wide divergence of opinion. There's about five definitions on trafficking, and people cannot even agree on that definition. I gave you a couple days ago the UN definition, but there's actually four or five different definitions that people are arguing about. And that's stalling some of these things being funded and some of the things happening. People disagree on what the solutions are. Should someone have a T visa? Should they be sent back and we should help them in their country? I mean, what are the different kinds of things that we can do? Also, there's political indifference to this issue. And we're not really sure why there's so much political indifference or why people don't seem to care about these girls and women. There's really not an explanation for it when you really think about it, if other than it doesn't seem to be affecting me personally or my community personally. So, but there seems to be a lot of political indifference in getting people to move and to do things about this. Most of our policies traditionally in the United States have punished the victims. So we punish the prostitutes, for example, and not the customer. And that continues to be part of the mentality, that we continue to punish the person that's been victimized. So to try and turn it around and say we have to go over after organized crime and we have to go after the traffickers, it's actually trying to change a mentality that's pretty well ingrained in our society about punishing the victim of that involved in sexual crimes. Again, there's a lack of information sharing. The only computer system that's being built in the United States right now to track this is the FBI is building a computer system, and that's still not done. They're still not done with deciding what's in the database, what do you keep, what do you need, how do you determine who's trafficked, who's smuggled, is there a difference between those two things? The other thing we're up against when we look at solutions is that the INS focuses on deporting people. I mean, that's basically their focus. You're found, you've got to go back. And from one perspective, if you really start thinking about all the different problems that immigrants bring, everybody who comes in has a problem. I mean, everybody's got issues. So it's like, do we you know, individualize each deportation case and really think about the situation of that person, or do we just have blanket laws no matter what? Because everyone comes from poverty, everybody comes from issues, so it's really hard to sort of say, you're deported and you're not, you were trafficked, you weren't. Because again, everybody's escaping this kind of political problems or poverty or whatever, and so it's hard for the INS to start to individualize each case. And there's going to need to be some different considerations for people. And again, is there a difference between being trafficked and being smuggled? Some people say there is, some people say no. If you're smuggled, you voluntarily involved yourself in it. You gave money, you said, I want to be smuggled, or I want to get to the United States. When you're trafficked, it's normally an involuntary, from a kidnapping to being told you're going to be working legitimately and so on. So some people say there's no difference. Some people say there is a difference between smuggling and trafficking. And that's something I think we need to think about. And the continuous issue is, how do you decide who? And one of the reasons is that, how do you prove the case of the person? Because when you're concerned with organized crime, there's not going to be any evidence. It's going to be their word against someone else. It's going to be their word against someone who's powerful, who has a lot of money, who can create a whole story. Yesterday I talked about the girl who was threatened, and they said if she went to the authorities, they'd say she stole $10,000 and she was a thief and all of these things. So they have these elaborate ways of getting people not to talk and not to talk against them. So you're up against that. And foreign governments, when they're complicit with trafficking, when they know about it, if we just decide to have sanctions internationally and we sanction these governments, then it's counterproductive because they're already in poverty. And if we give some kind of trade sanctions or financial sanctions, what do we do? But how do we get them to cooperate with us without giving sanctions out of being punitive? Another question. And the last thing people ask about, is the United States government adequately organized to even combat this? And it doesn't seem so. It doesn't. If you just look at the recent troubles with the FBI on the most base level, and I saw a joke about the FBI, and I think it had missing items, you know, and they had guns, and they had all these different things, and then they had Timothy McVeigh's file, and over that they had like a check mark that said found, you know? So it's sort of, when you look at what basic day-to-day, not keeping a file, or you losing computer information. They're not connected. None of our agencies are connected in this country. So this interagency cooperation would have to take place, and then international cooperation. So, and again, if we have these executive reporting requirements, what is reported? So these are some of the proposed problems. Some people say the steps that we have begun to take are insufficient. Most people argue that it's not going to work right now. And even the INS, the CIA, and the FBI all say that trafficking is going to continue to go up in volume. It's not going to go down, that this is just sort of the beginning. Why is it going to keep going up? Well, first of all, there's a low risk of prosecution. If you look at the statistics for cases that are actually prosecuted, it's ridiculous. You might see in New York 17 out of how many over the years where we know brothels will set up, Chinese gangs are running brothels, all kinds of elaborate businesses in Florida, and you'll look there and it'll be 14 prosecutions, something like that. So they know there's a low risk of being caught and a very low risk of being prosecuted. They know there's a huge potential for profit and that it's going to be difficult to get witnesses against them. And we still will have lack of economic opportunity in other parts of the world. So as long as that creates the conditions for women and girls and men to want to get out of their country, we're going to have trafficking. So when we think about maybe in a different way, not so much in the laws and the amendments, which are important, but what else can be done philosophically or in our thoughts or our actions, what we can do. I think that, first of all, internally, people have to realize that everyone has the fundamental right not to be sexually exploited and not to accept it, and not to accept it when you see it or you hear it or somebody's making jokes about it, and to educate our children that again in a rap song, calling someone a hoe and degrading her is not okay. And to educate our children in that way and educate our girls about what boundaries are and educate our boys about respecting women and not making fun of them, to combat it on the most fundamental level and to not separate prostitutes from the rest of society. And, you know, it's okay there, but it's not okay here, because it's not okay there. And to be more inclusive when we see them as being victimized people. I think we have to repudiate all attempts to legitimize prostitution as work. I think that's very important, and I think it's important to make that argument when people talk about, oh, it'd be okay if we just legitimize it. I think we need to really fight that and fight that notion and talk about, let's think about how someone ends up in prostitution, what happened to that person prior to the age of 18 when they were a child and they couldn't make any decisions. You know, it's easy to say, well, she's 21 now, or she's 25. But I think the essential thing is what happened to you before you were 18 years old. Because most women in prostitution get involved as teens or younger in some way. Or the plate is set in that way. I mean, this is what's going, you know, this and this happens and these things contribute. So we need to think of prostitution as not protecting our children, not about a free choice that a grown woman makes, because it's a very different idea when you sit down and you talk to them. We also talk about, yesterday it came up, well, some women are okay with it. But I think when we know statistically that 89 to 91% of women in prostitution say they want to get out, I think that gives us a lot of people to focus on. And so if we have a minor percent that say I'm okay in this place, that's fine. But I think we need to think about the 89 to 91% that say, if you had programming, I would get out of this tomorrow if you would help me. That's what we need to focus on, because most women in prostitution feel that way. We need to strengthen, there are two international human rights instruments that actually, if you can believe it, were drafted in 1949 after the war, because there was so much going on, and it was a convention. And the convention was on the trafficking of persons, the exploitation of the prostitution of others, and believe it or not, the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women, 1949. They established these things in 49 as essentially vital human rights. And this is the only thing that gives us a potential wedge against pimps and traffickers. And I think really, if you get into international issues and you can give any testimony or get involved in any way, it's important that this be strengthened. And what it did, what the problem was, because it was so outrageous at that time to talk about prostitution and women's rights, that it was ratified by only a few countries. And now someone to replace this convention with something that deals only with trafficking. But really, that's not going to be any good, because it would limit the attack against the sex industry. It would just be about trafficking, and it would be much weaker. And you'd have to have concrete proof of deception and force. And again, where are they going to get concrete proof? And yesterday I mentioned that sometimes they're moved from to as many as 11 cities in every 15 days. So how is this person going to get any proof against anyone? I think the other thing we look at is revolutionizing, and we're really talking about revolution with the criminal justice system. And we can get into a lot of criminal justice issues, but women are being incarcerated at 10 times the rate of men. Women in prostitution are nonviolent offenders. 70% of women that are incarcerated have children under the age of 18. And I just want you to think about this for a moment. You have a nonviolent offender. She has children now. These children are now in the foster care system. And some foster care homes are good. Some foster care homes are really bad. Children are hurt there and molested there. In Cook County, it costs $32,000 to incarcerate a woman for 1 year. For her children in foster care, it's $20,000 to $25,000 per child annually, depending on how much therapy they need, how much medical help they need, what groups they have to attend, etc. So now let's say maybe she's sick, maybe she has hepatitis, maybe there's something else wrong. Tack on another $20,000. You're paying sometimes as much as $80,000, you the taxpayer, to lock a nonviolent offending woman with children up in prison or in jail. That's your money. It's the, one of the fastest growing growth industries in the United States is the Department of Corrections. And they go into small towns that are factory towns that are in poverty, and they say, oh, you know, we'll build a prison here, and then we'll have jobs, and we'll have carpenters, and we'll have bricklayers, and we'll have cooks, and we'll have guards, and we'll have people supplying us. So we have gotten to the point we have 2% of our population locked up in this country, which is more than any civilized Western country. Now, I used to point out that it was 3 times as many people as in Iran, but then someone pointed out to me that you really can't commit a crime in Iran because you'll be killed. So, you know, they just don't commit crimes in Iran. So that's not really a good comparison. But, I mean, I think we have to look at this because we're really being fueled by this lock-em-up mentality. And Ted Koppel did a great special on it. And he said that we could send her to Harvard. Think about that. For the amount we're spending to lock her up and have her kids in foster care. Now, like anyone else, sure, do I have questions about psychopaths and sociopaths? Sure I do. You know, I mean, those are, do you want them being, but we're talking about nonviolent people who want rehabilitation, who respond very well to rehabilitation. By contrast, it's something like in our program, $17,000 to $18,000 a year, and we have a 60% success rate of rehabilitating women. But for some reason, the money gets put into incarceration and it does not get put into rehabilitation. And even when you look at rehabilitation, the insurance industry fuels rehabilitation. So it's going to be, you know, a 28-day stay or an 18-day stay or something like that. But what do you do in 18 days? Where are you going to go in 28 days? You're going to go back to your neighborhood where people are using crack. You're going to go back to the same place you were abused and show up as an outpatient. Well, you know, what if you don't have teeth in your mouth? What if you don't have any job training? You know, what good is going to an outpatient program every day? You know, it's meaningless, but because the insurance industry says you can only stay in here, and what we really need to do is look at that second tier, that tier when you get out of either jail or prison, or when you get out of drug treatment, the safety net. Where's the safety net that actually gets someone back into society and supports them getting back there? And that's, I really think, again, you get to blame the victim mentality, because if our programs aren't adequate and we don't give people what they need, then we can turn around and say, well, you know, they had a 28-day drug program, but they didn't get well. Well, they still don't have a job, they still don't have health care, they still don't have mental health care, and again, they don't have adequate living. So, okay, that's nice, and I think I would argue that anyone who's locked up somewhere can stay off drugs and alcohol for 28 days or 21 days. It's really not that hard. It's when you get out. And that's when you really need the support. So we really promote all of that very strongly. And that is, again, to really start looking at our system. Oops, I'm on the wrong side. Okay. I keep dropping my notes. Okay. Okay, there we are. Okay, we were at the 1929. So we look at the criminal justice system. Women especially have to look at it. Why are we being incarcerated at 3 times the rate? One thing that's been mentioned is often women can't be witnesses because they don't have the information in a drug deal or something, and they can't go to court and actually get out in a program to witness against somebody else. They're usually ignorant of what's going on. They might be being used in that situation. So they may often get longer sentences than the drug dealer himself that was really the criminal and used her to do whatever he wanted her to do. I think the other thing is that we really have to insist on justice and think about justice issues and what's important and really protect our women and children. And in Chicago we see, again, people say it's not, even if it's international, but nationally it's not my daughter. It is people's daughters. It is people's daughters. It's people from all over. We have girls that come from Wisconsin and Iowa and who run away and who end up with a pimp. It is people's daughters. And again, it's this separatism of thinking it's not about me. You know, it's about someone else. It's really not about someone else. all kinds of, you know, I mean, there's a very affluent suburb in Chicago, and we had a girl from there who started out, she was like one of those persons who went to bachelor parties and danced at bachelor parties and so on and so on, and led from one thing to another, and eventually got a pimp and eventually got addicted. Many times when girls are dancing, they're given drugs, you know, to either enhance their dancing or stay skinny or whatever it needs to be. So it's pervasive in all these clubs, these dance clubs you see. That is the crossover to prostitution. So you have to really open your eyes and see what's going on when you see that all girls nude dancing. And I see those way out in the country. I just got back from Alaska and I saw that stuff everywhere in Alaska. So we have to also successfully prosecute pimps and push for that, and push for their prosecution, and that who's ever involved in this be prosecuted more than the women, not as much as more than she does. The customers, we have to look at the customers. These customers are perpetuating sexual exploitation. If you're a customer and you're out there on the street, or you're going to the dance place, or you're stopping your car on the way home from work and telling someone to get in the car, you are just as guilty, if not more so. And that's another thing in this society. Why is it that everybody gets angry at the prostitutes? You know, they're mad at them, you know? And nobody's mad at the person that's oh, boys will be boys. Or a woman even mentioned to me and how boys sometimes are taken to prostitutes by their fathers for their rite of passage. I grew up on a border town. I grew up in El Paso, Texas, and that was extremely common. That, you know, you go over the border to Mexico and you go to a brothel there and you get with a prostitute, and that's like your rite of passage. And young boys, there was no age limit there in Mexico, and it was well known in the high schools and everything else, go get drunk, go to Mexico, go to brothel. It was completely accepted. I mean, just as a way of life. And I think back on that now, I think it's kind of strange, you know, that, and the fathers encouraged it. So, you know, we have to say that, start to teach people that's not okay. We have to push for legislation for witness protection for victims, because if the victims can't testify against these people, they're not going to be locked up. Nothing's going to happen. I think we need to be perhaps more liberal about grants for asylum, even if it's temporary asylum. And I know immigration is a huge problem, and we're trying to figure out all different things about immigration. But still, if the person would have asylum to at least testify, we can begin to put some teeth in some of these proposed laws. And again, we do have existing criminal penalties which are not being enforced, and they should be enforced. All these penalties that exist on the books should be enforced, and the priorities have to be there. Huge prevention campaigns for our girls, and educating the public about the harm of sexual exploitation. I think we also need to demand as people that the governments and the private sector develop and expand programs. And I really want to talk about, if you look at, first of all, we had animal protection laws in the United States. You may or may not be aware of this, before we had laws protecting our children. And you go back and you look at and you think about the laws for sexual assault and the laws for domestic violence. These are very, very recent. And this would have never happened in our country unless people just started demanding it. If people stood up and said, you know, we want to protect our children, then we don't have to stay. You know, no, you can't kill me like you can in Texas. For example, if you're an adulteress, the husband has a right to kill you, you know. And he usually gets off for doing that. I think we have to look at, for sexual exploitation, the way we looked at domestic violence and rape 20, 25 years ago, and see that we're just on the beginning of that, and we need to have the same kind of services. So if you want to leave prostitution, you want to leave dancing, you have to have somewhere to go. And you have to have counseling, and you have to have classes about jobs, and you have to have medical care. And most of the women need to have parenting classes, because obviously they haven't had very good parenting themselves in most cases. And so they have to learn how to be parents and to be better parents than their parents were. Because we know a lot of these things are cyclic and they're generational. It goes down. And as I mentioned yesterday, 50% of kids of parents that have been incarcerated end up being incarcerated themselves. So, you know, we have to look at that. So if we're going to take people out of these situations, then we have to provide counseling about parenting, psychological counseling, post-traumatic stress syndrome counseling, all these kinds of things. But the same thing for sexually exploited people. We've never offered anything. I mean, basically, maybe religious sanctuary, which I always talk about in religious settings, that is the bottom of the pyramid. I mean, spirituality is the building block, but nothing's ever gone on and built the pyramid. All these other services, job training, housing, medical care, counseling, parenting skills, child care. We sort of build the pyramid from that spiritual base, religious base, but it's not enough unless you have all the other concrete services on there. And there's, again, like I say, if we're the biggest organization in the United States, that kind of shows you how few organizations there really are right now. But again, we saw 13,000 last year, women and girls, but it still shows you how little is going on to help women that are being persecuted in this manner. The other thing we look at is substance abuse programs for the women, and substance abuse programs that work. We know the rate of recidivism for people that go through substance abuse programs. That's because most of them are fairly inadequate or too short-term to do anything. So if you have a lot of recidivism, you might look at why? Why do we just keep doing the same old thing in drug treatment over and over and over again when we have this high rate of recidivism? And there are programs that do work. And for example, when I was in San Francisco, they had acupuncture. They had a full-time person doing acupuncture there, which has shown to be very effective for people that have had addiction problems. That, you know, I'd heard about it, but realizing they had a full-time staff person every day, and she was booked solid, I mean, with the women coming in for appointments, healing massage, other kinds of things holistically to bring into our drug treatment programs that we know work, post-traumatic stress syndrome and trauma survivor counseling for domestic violence victims and sexual survivors, permanent housing. And I know a lot of people will say, oh, you know, no matter how conservative you are, no matter how liberal you are, we want the women off the corners. Oh, they have to get off the corner. You know, they're ruining our property values and so on. And this digresses from trafficking. But, I mean, logic dictates if you want people off the corners, you know, they have to have somewhere to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, hello, you know, other than jail. You know, because jail just turns you in and turns you out right back to the corner. You know, with no intervention. And believe it or not, we have lots of sympathetic judges who listen to us and lots of sympathetic lawyers who are tired of seeing people over and over in front of them, sicker and sicker, worse and worse, and more poverty week after week. So we do, it doesn't fall on deaf ears. I mean, there are people that are beginning to say, is there something else I could do? But again, there's very little housing. There's very little places for them to go. And you actually have to have a whole, which is another issue, but even you get into zoning issues because, of course, nobody wants you there in their neighborhood. So it's, you know, it's very hard. We're fighting a battle right now about zoning where we are. And, you know, the other thing is that these sex industry defenders, as I'll call them, and the big defenders, believe me, are people that are making lots of money off of the sex industry. And they have succeeded really in persuading a lot of people that the global sex trade, it can't be eliminated. You know, you'll hear people stand up and go, you can't be eliminated, you just have to regulate it. You know, and the truth is that it can be. And if we really stand up and we say that and they'll say, well, you can't stop it, so you regulate it and you organize it. This is what you have to do, regulate it, organize it, you know. And the thing is, if you test the women, for example, for sexual diseases, are you testing the customers? Because we have reports of women that have left Nevada. The men aren't tested, but they are. And the thing is, you could test negative today for HIV, and you could be positive tomorrow, you know, if you're giving that test monthly. So that's ridiculous to regulate and organize it. I think we have to insist as people that the sexual exploitation of new generations and populations of women and children is unacceptable. It's unacceptable, and speak out about it. And again, it's wrong. When they try and convince you that this can be regulated and you have to accept it, it's as old as the world and it's going to keep going on, I think that's wrong. Because it's the same idea that race-based slavery is inevitable, that it's okay to enslave people because of their color. You know, and that was accepted. You know, and it's no longer accepted. And I think we have to feel the same way about sexual exploitation of people. And I think the way domestic violence went with their zero tolerance campaign, that there will be no violence against women, I think we have to campaign for the same zero tolerance policies for the universal human rights of women and children. And one thing I want to kind of end my discussion today, and I have some questions if you don't have any, with somebody's effort, one of the first efforts, and to help women. And this is the Newsday.com. One of the things I have lots of information. I'm being smuggled for sex and human trafficking, and there's lots of information now, and that's in your handouts. But this article's called Reaching Out to Victims. It's from Romania. It says, with 10 young women and a puppy, living in a one-bedroom railroad flat, quarters are close in the apartment where psychologist Ayana Mate runs a program she calls Reaching Out. On a recent day, the shoddy communist-era construction let moisture in through the walls and the lighting was dim. A solitary red Christmas stocking hung from the wall. She let the Newsday reporter in on the condition that the resident's last name would not be used. The place was warm and the conversation was lively. Inside the small kitchen, Georgiana, 18, was preparing a fragrant meal of duck stew and soup. The tall, shy young woman, Matei said, had been trafficked from Romania to Albania and kept by her pimp as a trophy girlfriend. In the living room, Mariana, 24, who had been rescued by United Nations police from a bar in Macedonia, was relaxing and practicing her English with a visitor. I like the computer. All the time I like writing friends with email, she said. Like the others in the program, she said she's keen to learn computer skills so she can make her way into the dot-com world. The women in the apartment in this provincial city are all refugees from the world of sexual trafficking. Young women who say they were tricked or forced into the lives of prostitution. Amid the large-scale migration of Eastern European women to feed the needs of sex businesses, Matei's program is the first, and so far the only, facility in Romania that helps build new lives for such women. Modest as her program is in scale, serving fewer than 20 women in two cramped apartments, it has drawn the attention of high-ranking U.S. officials, including the FBI and the State Department, who were seeking guidance on how to deal with sex trafficking and how to learn about trafficking networks in the region. It is literally a model, the U.S. ambassador said. This kind of shelter is very important. You obviously have young women very traumatized and who need a helping hand to recover and get on with their lives. Reaching Out can set up a haven in Bucharest. The money, part of a $300,000 grant, is funneled through the International Organization for Migration, a group of 65 member nations that works to help migrants. So I thought that was a really positive example of how a little bit of money, really, and when you think there's billions in some of the accounts of the State Department and so on that for immigration, can really start to help people and how basic it is. So that's why I always encourage people, you never know who's going to go back and start a little small place. And then our place started as one little house, I think with four beds. And now we have three locations, 30-some beds, and saw 13,000 people last year. So I think some things can start. And so if people are interested in it, you could support them. If you're interested in it, there is funding available for it to help others. So I just want to leave you with that thought. and ask you if you have any questions or what you think about the controversy among helping them.
It seems like just reading the papers, one of the things that gets a lot of attention is when folks in a particular neighborhood get together and say, you know, we don't want this going on our block and do anything for two blocks over, but at least, you know, and they get out with cameras and take pictures of the potential Johns driving by and kind of reclaim their space. Does that help or is that...
I think what we do is, in Chicago, that's called CAPS, the Citizens Blah 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 Program. And ours is based on San Francisco's program. And what we do is work hand in hand with them. And what I was trying to do in terms of working with people, regardless of how conservative or liberal they are, is the idea that we know that incarceration is a failure, and that yes, we support you. We support your desire to have the women out of the neighborhood. We too want the women out of the neighborhood. But what is the humane way to do it? And I think when you say, yeah, we support, you know, we're not saying, no, we want them to stand on your corner. We understand how you feel about that. And I think when you go about it in that way, in a unifying way, and will you support us? I'll support you. You support me on getting funding from Mayor Daley, in my case. Then I'll support you. And we actually we send our workers, not me personally, I mean, all of us speak. Everybody in my group speaks. And we go and we stand up at the CAPS meetings and say, then you should be supporting our program. We're Genesis House and this is what we do. And I think I didn't know there was somewhere the women could go where they would be helped. And I can tell you, rarely if ever do we get a negative response. About 70% of our women that do direct service are in recovery themselves. And normally what I like to do is bring someone along and wait for the judge or whoever to say all these horrible things, like they never get well, they can't be helped, blah, 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 blah. And then at the end, you know, she'll always go, oh, by the way, I'm recovered from prostitution. Oh, you? Oh, well, I didn't mean you. I mean somebody other than you can't be helped, you know. And it's always embarrassing because I think when you have living, breathing examples of survivors who are fine and who are working and who got the proper help, some are married, some have children, homes, jobs, education, master's degrees, it's a testimonial. So we try and put our personal money where our mouth is and hire women that are survivors and train them and give them opportunities.
I was reading in the news magazine here just a few weeks ago about in some of these poor foreign countries where these prostitution rings go over there and buy these girls from their parents. And that was startling to me. I couldn't believe that. But is there the greedy prostitutes, you know, they take them wherever they wanted to take them, any place, not just America, but around other countries in the world. Mm-hmm. Isn't there some way that these prostitution rings can be eliminated, actually just wiped out?
Well, that's what...
The kids that stay home would still be poor, but at least they wouldn't be sold by their parents. You know, I couldn't hardly believe that.
Well, we get, again, with the fact that it's organized crime, and the money that organized crime is getting is used to corrupt officials. You've got this huge, I mean, same as with the drug trafficking, where border agents are paid off. It's huge corruption. And I read something that was disturbing, and I know I've said it in these sessions, that they sell her for the price of a toaster. I mean, think what a toaster costs, $20? You know, an average toaster. And so you've got these huge, I mean, I think when I'm researching it, sometimes it's very overwhelming almost, the roots of the organized crime, the parents that sell the child. And again, which is why I get back to these laws we're looking at, and prosecution, unless people get in trouble and get prosecuted for it, it's going to continue. And the only way we can do that is to, like this T visa that's very controversial, but we have to somehow protect the witnesses and make it easy for them and somehow make them get them a life somehow, you know, after they're kidnapped. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, you can't just live on nothing while you're witnessing. You can't be an illegal immigrant and be if you speak out, the INS is going to know you're there and they're going to deport you. So everything, this is why a lot of, everything's working against prosecuting these people. And And I was talking about Albania, where if you go back and you tell on who kidnapped you, they kill you, gangland style. They kill you. They shoot you through the head and leave you. And I think it's 1 in 3 of their girls under 18 or something, or under 20, are being kidnapped off the streets. And then if they don't kill you, if you get away, they kill your family as a warning, you know, that you told. And citizens in these poor countries have no mechanisms to stand up against organized crime. It's horrific. And, you know, and again, they, if it's not you, it's your family. They'll threaten your family.
Have there been grassroots approaches through nonprofit organizations, U.S. Agency for International Development, UN, that kind of mimic what's been going on over the past 10, 15 years with programs in Africa and other developing nations, where they've been going in and teaching women things like birth control? They've been teaching them about child care. They've been teaching them about a greater age span between children. They've been teaching them about clean water supplies. They've been teaching them about all these other things. And they've actually empowered the women in many of these households to take charge. And many of these programs, at least when I was studying them 5 years ago, were very successful. Can we do a dual-pronged approach where we've got NGOs, which are non-government organizations? They can be either Christian-based or non-Christian-based.
Or the Peace Corps.
Or the Peace Corps can do it, UN can do it, U.S. Agency for International Development. There's a lot of agencies out there. Is there any way to get them together to attack it from both ends?
Yeah, I think that's just in its infancy stage, and I think until 1998 there were no coordinated efforts, and there was no support of not-for-profits doing that either, which is what we talk about, you know, Catholic workers, I mean, any of these organizations, Lutheran Social Service organizations, so on and so forth. But just now they're making money available, and the amendment, which I think actually fell on the floor by Congressman Smith, calls for $30 million, because even though this act went through, there was no money. So he said, well, this is a really nice, flowery, wonderful thing to write, but there's no money allocated for it. So his amendment is for $30 million to start all of these efforts, and that's sending people, you know, via the consulates or grassroots organizations or not-for-profits to do the education, to come in and, again, give the women alternatives to something else. I mean, for those who actually sign up for sex work, because they have no alternatives, to begin grassroots efforts at job training, other ways for them to make money. So finally, I think that's going to go through the 30 million, and I think that's pretty much what everybody's, a lot of, I know organizations like mine are waiting for that to go through, so you have some capital to work with. Then you normally have to write, you know, your RFP and get going and get out there. But I think it's being done. I know we work with someone who goes nationally and internationally for other issues. He works with a needle exchange program. And via the United States government, they send him abroad to Eastern Europe and so on because of the rise of AIDS and addictions in other countries, which is also running rampant. So they're doing it, but not on a large coordinated scale. I think this is, like, now's the time when finally, and that's why we're going and talking, and this is the time when finally people should really try and be aware of it, and even missionaries be aware of it. Everyone needs to be aware of it and start training and empowering women.
It would be really nice if somebody went to George Bush and Pope and said, you know, these families are having too many female babies and therefore they are going into prostitution. Would you like to make a statement on that?
Laura did, and she doesn't agree with George. Laura believes in a woman's right to choose.
Yes.
There it is. There it is.
Would you repeat that? What did she say?
She believes in a woman's right to choose.
Laura Bush.
That librarian. Quietly, she's. I think she's probably a very strong person underneath that.
I'm holding everything I got in her right now.
I
have a question, but this lady in white is
I'm sorry.
Gail, you spoke about how on the international level that a woman that's found or turns herself in is basically just sent to back to her country where she's unwelcome, she has no care, no money.
Well, think if your parents sold you and you're sent back.
Right. I think what the way that you explained it is, it's just easier for the law to handle her that way. On a domestic level, the same occurrence happens. A woman that has been brutally raped or physically abused, mentally abused, and goes to the authorities for help, but most of the time is arrested because of her background. Mm-hmm. And she isn't given any help right here in our own country. So I think a good focus would be to try to get some type of task force that would really look at the law enforcement agencies that handle these things.
Well, you're right. And in this country, I mean, we go back to, you know, the Scarlet Letter and all this, and we have a real good girl versus bad girl mentality. And I think that often if someone is being sexually exploited or is in sex work, their credibility is often doubted.
Right.
And that's why they're not believed about rapes and they're not believed about other kinds of things, because there's already a credibility gap there when they're going to say something. And that's very, very prevalent. I mean, not only just among women. I know that I had to go, for our domestic violence funding, I had to go down to Springfield, the capital, and testify in front of this. It was really, I thought I was going to talk to one person, a legislative liaison, and I went down and it was like, I walked in, it was the head of all the departments of human services for the state of Illinois with like a microphone and you know, a conference call. And I wasn't prepared for that. And I wanted domestic violence funding because it's the only violence against women funding that I could access for our women. And they were being murdered, you know, slaughtered in Chicago. There were mass murders. And it was really funny because the big point was that I couldn't get the women to prosecute anyone, and I couldn't get them to get an order of protection against someone. Now, the reason being, and I kept trying to logically explain, but this is kind of the government, you know, is that A, they don't know who he is. Number one, if someone pushes you out of a car or strangles you or stabs you or puts barbed wire around your neck, like some construction worker killed someone about a year ago, she doesn't know who he is. She doesn't know it. She didn't ask for his wallet and his ID, number one. Number two, even if it is somebody she knows, he's often a pimp or a powerful drug dealer person who will kill her if she takes any legal action against him. So I kept arguing, it was kind of odd, you know, that the whole thing is, to me, it's about the woman and the children. Isn't it to get her away from violence? Is the spirit of the law to prosecute someone, or is the spirit of the law to help someone out of violence? So this went on for a while, back and forth. And then finally I said, well, you know, I guess because someone doesn't know who killed them, they're really not any less dead, are they? I mean, like, what's the difference? And I just think you're being discriminatory. So it seemed like discrimination was the magic word. And they gave me, $75,000, and the city of Chicago gave me about $50,000. But, I mean, I'm telling you, and each time we have to defend why we haven't walked them through the order protection process, it's like, they don't know who he is.
In Pennsylvania, often the police will make the charge, even if the women do not, and they seem to be pretty good about doing that. And actually, I had an interesting experience. I sat on a jury where the issue was domestic violence, and both the man and the woman denied that there was any violence going on, and he was still convicted.
Wow, that's really great. Because the women are afraid. I mean, you know, and our women are very afraid. I mean, they will get killed, they will get hurt. And there's no doubt about it. So it's different.
Two quick things. I wonder if you, with
all of this, you know, compelling case and argument and inspiring, has there been any department of the church, the Lutheran Church, that has taken a special interest in this? I know we have a Office of Governmental Affairs in D.C. that tries to study legislation and alert concerned congregations and persons about pending legislation and, you know, educational opportunities. We have Church and Society Office in Chicago. It seemed to me that, you know, my gosh, you are a wonderful resource, and there may be kind of in place, you know, an institutional megaphone to assist you.
Ooh.
That's one question.
That would be nice.
It may be replicated in many other denominations, but I know that there are those offices within the ELCA. The second is,
I should put Fourth Presbyterian and other people, but not so much the Lutheran Church.
Okay.
And Catholic Church, actually.
Well, we had a.
But we need to talk.
Yeah. The other thing is, how do you stay sane?
Am I? No.
Probably not.
Just kidding. I am.
How do your coworkers stay centered, healthy, balanced, have a home life? You're very passionate about this, and I'd be, you know, pastorally concerned for you and those who are part of your organization that you don't burn out in 2 months.
Well, we do. I mean, I'm very aware of that, and I think one thing we do encourage is a lot of vacation and a lot of comp time, a lot of training, a lot of counseling. We encourage individual counseling, so if somebody, you know, to really, it's not a bad thing. It's very much encouraged for people to get support. If you're in recovery, we very much encourage you to have a sponsor and to be attending 12-step groups. Myself personally, I just got back, well, actually I worked in San Francisco, but from San Francisco and then a pleasure trip in Alaska, and now I'm here. So I really try and take care of myself, and I encourage everybody. And I think I sort of came through the ranks. Personally, if I had a supervisor that I disliked, I'd figure out why I disliked them, what they were doing to me that I thought was torturous. So I try not to do that to other people. I've tried to write all those things down and be really flexible about time. We're not rigid about scheduling in too many ways. And if you need time off for a family reason, some people have had to bring their kids to work for one reason or another. We encourage that. And then also we have a retreat, an overnight retreat out in the country where we do outdoor team building physical stuff, and then the next day we have an outside consultant do team building with us. So we recognize birthdays, and we give money for Christmas, and we have parties. And I think one thing, we're all together and we celebrate when someone graduates. We have a huge party and a really wonderful celebration, and it's a very happy, there's lots of happy events too. I mean, we're not focusing on them right now, but there are lots of really happy events, and we all celebrate and sing and give presents and wish them well and move them into their new house and stay in touch. So, I mean, there's lots of really happy, where you're really happy when someone, and we welcome people back. They'll come back. I mean, one woman came back, and she used to be a female head of the Latin Kings in Chicago, and she's now a librarian in the suburbs. You know, it's like, don't tell me what she did. I don't want to know. You know, and she'll come back, and just to see how great I'm doing. You know, so there's lots of really great moments like that when people just come. It's like, you're a librarian. Where? Oh, look out, town. You know, but you have great moments like that because people always come back when they're doing well to show you. You know, they really want you to see I'm doing great now. So there's lots of really great moments and great days and happy moments and funny moments, you know.
I don't know exactly how to ask this, but, and it's not, I mean, you've talked about trafficking a lot of this. I guess my concern is, in our own society, how it seems like some of, you know, like you're talking about strip dancers and all that, is being glamorized for our youth. Like,
sure.
That's something to head for, boy. You know, that's
mm-hmm.
great. And where, you know, where are we combating that kind of attitude to helping them share the story of, you start, you know, just like what you said, you start there and then this is...
We're not, and actually we have a board member who's 75 and she's just dear, and she wrote a long article on it, and she wrote something called the human, what did she call it? It was an interesting topic, the human curriculum. And what she really proposed, because I mean, when we go into schools right now, they're telling people to abstain. Even though statistics are telling us that kids are having sex younger and younger, you know, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky gave oral sex, you know, the stamp of approval for everyone, you know, they think this is a neat thing to do now.
And it's not even sex.
Right, they don't think so, you know, until they get syphilis in their mouth, they don't think it's sex. You know, surprise! But, you know, and she said we really need to start getting into the school system and somehow talking about healthy male-female relationships, healthy sexuality, but it's so taboo when they're still pretty, you know, that it's really not, I mean, unless it happens in the home, and the big problem is you have a lot of responsible, great parents that teach respect for the sexes and respect for each other, but you have a lot of homes that don't, and if you're not getting it at home, you're also not getting it at school. You know what I mean? When we were even digressed to talk about the Columbine thing and how we were all saying, you know, if I had been building something in my garage for 7 months, my parents would have been out every 5 minutes. What are you doing? What's it for? What are you making? Do you need help? You know, do you need some string? How did they not know that these kids were doing this in the garage for 7 months?
I think a lot of parents
that's scary.
Are afraid of their kids. I think a lot of parents are afraid.
That's on the cover of Time last week. Did you see it?
I was up here.
Taking power back from kids. It's the cover of Time magazine. But I also think, so they're developing their attitudes about sexuality from MTV, from videos. They're seeing a lot about sexuality, but it's not healthy. I mean, that's the problem. It's not like they're not seeing anything, but what's being fed in is not good stuff. So you're right. I mean, but people won't even look at that in the school system. It's scary for them, but they do, they'll look at AIDS and things, but not healthy sexuality and healthy relationships. Any other? Purple?
The question that I was originally going to ask, you had mentioned that the success rate was only 60%. Does that mean that some of these people who weren't successful come back?
Yes.
And succeed the second or the third or the fifth?
Well, some years we've had as high as 80% success rate, and that's staying out of prostitution.
Yeah.
And addictions.
Yeah.
And then, so I think the average comes to about 60. Mm-hmm. But when you think about prison, that there's an 80% recidivism rate, and for us, 40, that's a huge leap. And some, you know, actually it would probably be higher because we track people for as long as 10 years. And in fact, we just testified for a congressman, and three of my graduates were there, and he was kind of asking me, how do you know, how do you keep track? And I couldn't reveal because of confidentiality, but I want to say, well, I know where three of them are right now. They're testifying in front of you. But we do home visits. So some years it's higher, but I would say the average might be a little, last year it was 60%. But that's still much higher than incarceration.
Yeah.
Much higher.
I was just trying to figure out how you got the statistics.
Yeah.
Make statistics look.
This last year it was 60. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably if I average it out along, it'd be closer to 70. I mean, the year Time did it, we had 80%. And when I told the report, I said, we're only 60% this year, she went, oh! Any other questions?
Yes.
Hi.
That's two related questions. Has there been research done that has created a profile of what the customers are like? And are there any cities that have done things like arrest customers and publish their names, and does that change things?
The punitive sort of thing normally, you know, makes people angry and makes them not want to get caught. But the people that do keep the best, I think, stats are Toronto and San Francisco, who have that collaborative program on Johns. And they have a questionnaire that they keep afterwards. And so not only do they have the data, race, age, you know, all that stuff, They also have the attitude survey after they go through the Johns program. So I would say the best profiles are in the cities that have that data. And that program, the Johns program, the educational counseling program, has a 2% recidivism rate.
Wow.
It's an amazingly successful program. So I think that just shows you, I mean, when I look at the police data myself, and it's public information, so we look at it, and it'll tell his name, you know, where he was, what street corner he was on, everything about him. I mean, it's public information. I don't see, I mean, there's men of all races and all ages. I mean, you see 75-year-old men, you see 18-year-olds, but I think it would probably be more predominantly white males than minority males, but probably then, you know, maybe half white males, and then Latino males and African American males would make up the other 50%, but it's always more white males in all the statistics.
And what does this John program do is so successful?
Well, I think first of all, it's a diversion program. So I think the person can go through the legal process and maybe get in big trouble, or it can go into counseling. So I think some of it is the arm twisting part of, okay, I'll do this, but I really don't believe in it, but I don't want to get in trouble, or I don't want a record, so I'll go through this program. But it's an 8-part program, and it starts with sort of the legal end, where they scare you legally, and a prosecutor talks about, this is what I'm going to do to you if I catch you again. I mean, he really scares the pants off of you. And then the next thing is sexually transmitted diseases by the Department of Public Health, and they show all these scary, horrible, blistering, terrible sores and things that can happen. So, you know, that's kind of the point where they're like, ah! And then they sort of bring it down a few notches, and it gets a little more humane, and they have a panel of former women in prostitution who were at various levels and talk about what it was like. Then they have one prostitute, and I spoke with her and met with her. She was really cool. And she was a blue-eyed blonde lady, and she'd say, what do you think a prostitute looks like? I just loved her approach. And they'd say, you know, what they think, and she'd go, like me? And they'd say, oh, no, not like you. And then she'd say, how old do you think a prostitute is? You know, she'd go, who do you think looks like a heroin addict? And they'd say, and she'd go, like me? No, not like you. You know, and then at the end she says, well, I'm a prostitute, and I'm now working in this program. I'm a former prostitute, actually. And I was a heroin addict for 19 years, and she talks about it. And then after that, there's a male expert on sexual compulsivity and family relations. And he talks about the psychological issues and offers extended counseling through his program. So if somebody wants to keep up with it, they know where to get help. And then after that, they conduct the attitude survey and get information about them and so on. And then they keep the data on whether or not they're rearrested with the police department. And it's very successful. And I know that personally, when we've talked to people that are customers, more than once somebody's told me he really knows he needs help and he's messed up, but it's just like, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I don't know how to declare this problem. So I think there's a lot more people who need help than on that end that we're offering it to, too. And I think, again, you're much better off not, you know, I mean, probably people are seeking out prostitutes. Who knows what their guilt issues and stuff already, so now we're going to, like, punish you and humiliate you. That's a good idea. I'm sure he'll be psychologically more healthy once we humiliate him and put his name in the paper, you know, take his car. You know, so I think there should be a humane approach on both. Not again with traffickers and criminals, but I think some of the customers have a lot of issues themselves, you know, and who knows what they grew up with. And men can be sexually abused too, you know, and a lot of abusers grow up to be abusive. So, you know, we need to intervene. So if they're abusing women in prostitution, who knows what happened to them when they were kids? Maybe they were beaten up or sexually abused. You don't know. You know, so I mean, there's lots of stuff to look at both ends, and I always am proactive for helping people rather than punishing them. Any more? Ready for the buffet?
Thank you.
And then, like I say, tomorrow.